Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 30th day of March, 2024. I'm your host, Mark Call. And this week, we've seen yet another major example of the fact that, as Robert A. Heinlein used to once famously put it, never underestimate the power of human stupidity. There are so many people drinking the Kool-Aid and accepting that an amazing series of absolutely unbelievable events just happened to come together perfectly and result in the destruction of one of the key pieces of United States defense and national security infrastructure, the port at Baltimore and the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Literally severing I-695 and taking out one of the United States' major hazardous material processing centers into and out of the country, among a whole bunch of other things that make it being a target a whole hell of a lot more likely than it being an accident. So here's one of the important questions for today. Does it really matter? After all, it's a done deal. And the impacts, dramatic as they will be felt not for months but years. So, folks, I guess here's part of the answer, and the reason why it's relevant to the first segment of our look back at the news today. If it really was nothing but an accident, I guess it's almost impossible to have ever imagined it happening in the first place. And if it's that unlikely of an accident, you can rest assured it couldn't possibly happen again. Whereas, if it's not, do you really want to bet your life against the obvious? Or, as I'm going to point out, keep betting your life against the impossible series of incredibly unbelievable events that just seem to be happening regularly now? Almost like, as I've heard it put, a flock of black swans. Think of it this way, folks. If you were to go to, say, Las Vegas, start putting dollars in slot machines, and hit the jackpot on every single one of them 10 times in a row, well, that's possible, I guess. But I guarantee you, casino management is going to have some words with you in that little room. But if you're a swamp official, on the other hand, CNN, the WAPO, and the New York Times are all going to be pushing your story as if it was actually true. So I want to start off today with one of my favorite quotes from a really great novel that probably you've read. It has a lot of them, by the way. And it's Lewis Carroll's follow-on to the Alice in Wonderland book called Through the Looking Glass. The subject, arguably, is gullibility and believing impossible things, where Alice is talking to the Red Queen, and she laughs and says, "There's no use trying. One can't believe impossible things." "Well," said the Queen, "I dare say you haven't had much practice. When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I believed as many as 6 impossible things before breakfast." So except for perhaps lacking the proper sexual proclivities, the Red Queen could be the White House press secretary, and she certainly sounds like she'd be thrilled getting her news from the likes of CNN. As for the rest of us folks, we need to ask a lot more questions and be a whole heck of a lot less gullible. So let's start with that story I'm sure you've heard by now, the Baltimore Port and Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse after it got rammed by an out-of-control container ship. And before we even know how many people actually died, Big Brother's unconstitutional 3-letter agencies are out there telling people, along, of course, with the whores from the White Whorehouse, that although we haven't even pretended yet to have an investigation, that the one thing you know for sure is that it's not terrorism. Which, come to think of it, may be truer than they'd like you to believe. If they do it, it's not terrorism. It's not even election fraud. It's democracy. General Michael Flynn was on with Alex Jones, asked, "Can we take this idea that it's terrorism off the table?" He basically said, "Hell no. We absolutely cannot do that," said President Trump's former national security advisor. And General Flynn called the container ship ramming the 1.6-mile-long bridge at the port of Baltimore a black swan event, saying that both the national security implications and resulting economic devastation are unquestionably immense. From there, let's work our way forward slowly with a couple of related stories. First, from Cliff Kincaid about the terror attack, as he puts it, in Baltimore. Considering the reality, it begins, of Chinese and Russian cyber warfare, as documented, even by the FBI and other TLAs, the assumption had better be terrorism until somebody is able to prove otherwise. Once, folks, that would have been an unarguably valid point, even though what we saw was a clear exercise in government CYA. Continued Cliff Kincaid, "They must think we're fools, and on that there's no disagreement." Laura Logan appeared with Steve Bannon on his War Room show, and this is so important and so detailed, I'm going to play an extended excerpt now.
Laura, you've been on fire. I saw the Gateway Pundit piece that talked about what you're coming out with. We've had a Posobiec. Look, as a naval officer, I can tell you, something is not right about this situation. They got pilots, the most professional guys around. I don't know how they steered it at 8 knots right into the foundational element of the bridge. They could have dropped anchor. They should have had backup systems. You say there may be something. Here's the other thing that's concerned me. Why they run to the mic, had McCabe on this morning at sunrise on CNN saying it's not terrorism. It's not terrorism. It's not. It might not be terrorism.
And here again, folks, he's right. It might not be, but they do not know that. But to make that claim just plain, well, strains any credulity.
But why do you come to the mic right away? These are the type, we need facts. We need empirical evidence. We need an investigation. What is your investigation telling you?
Well, I have a better question for you, Steve. Why are you coming to the mic telling the country that it's not terrorism when your own intelligence agencies are telling you it is? And I know they are, because I didn't make this up. These are not my words, right? I'm talking to people who are on the inside, some who are on active duty, some who are retired, and everyone, literally, from critical infrastructure in Department of Homeland Security to the intelligence agencies, they know there's no other, this is a cyber attack on a critical infrastructure corridor for the United States. This is, you know, for those people who think this is just a river, this is in Baltimore, what does this matter? You don't know anything about what you're talking about. This, the I-94 corridor on the eastern seaboard is literally what connects the north and south. And when I talk about hazardous materials, right, this is a brilliant, well-planned strategic attack on one of the most important supply chains in the United States of America. The only other one is in the western side in California. That's the only one that's busier. And what you have done is you now have shut it down. And when I talk about hazardous materials, what are we talking about here? This is refined fuels, right? This is propane gas. This is diesel. This is fuel. This is flammable materials. This is oversized loads, nitrogen, chemicals, everything that you need for your economy to move has literally just been shut down for 4 to 5 years.
You got to admit, folks, that's impressive, even by deep state destruction standards.
And how did they do it? They knew that they had to target one of two main anchor points on that bridge. There are two load-bearing pylons that any structural engineer can identify that are on the end of each side of the bridge. These are the ones that are thicker and stronger than anything else on that bridge. And when you hit one of those pylons, when you take that out, the reason you see so much of that bridge collapse instantly is you just brought 50% of the span of that bridge coming crumbling down.
And she's right. And briefly, that is the thing that most struck me when I watched the video. It's literally like watching a bunch of dominoes come down.
And what you don't see beneath the surface of the water, Steve, is absolutely catastrophic. It is a structural nightmare and a logistical nightmare because you have the entire bottom part, the concrete part of that bridge, and you don't know the extent of the structural damage to that. And you won't know it until you pull all of that infrastructure out of there and you get to look at it. And so you're talking 3 to 5 years at best. And what you're talking about here is probably building a new bridge. So what you have effectively done now, you've shut down the I-95 corridor that's above ground. So now you're going to have to go north to New York. You're going to have to go south to North Carolina. Your trucks, your hazardous materials are going to have to go around Baltimore now. They're not going to be able to go through it. And what else did you do? You shut down the sea corridor, the shipping corridor, because now the port is shut down, right? And so all those tankers that are out at sea that have hazardous materials on them, those are going to have to all be rerouted. And why can you not move hazardous materials through the tunnel? Why is this such a big deal?
And here she goes into quite a bit of detail.
Because hazardous materials, for example, oversized loads, they don't fit in the tunnel system.
Yep.
And there's other loads that are so dangerous that they require a permit. It takes time to get a permit. It costs money to get a permit. It requires an escort, right? You've seen it on the highways sometimes. You've seen when you have these massive oversized loads and they've got escorts all around them, these huge convoys. Well, what do you do on one of the busiest corridors in the United States? You don't shut it down in the day so this can happen. That means you can only move this stuff at night, which automatically impacts the amount of traffic that you can use. The tunnel is going to be overloaded. This is what you call death by a thousand cuts. It is an absolutely catastrophic attack on critical infrastructure, and you cannot see it because a cyber attack is unseen, just like the attack on 2020 on the voting machine that you cannot see.
Not only that, folks, it looks like they don't want you to see. They're not going to allow you to see. They're going to keep on lying, and they're going to tell you you're a conspiracy theorist if you see something that they just aren't going to allow. Understand, too, that they're not about to tell you what the real effects of this are going to be down the line. But they're going to be very, very real and very, very destructive, as almost certainly planned. By Thursday morning, we were starting to see some separation in the oil and water of propaganda, where the Gateway Pundit featured an update via Laura Logan that says, in the aftermath of that unbelievable set of coincidences, yeah, sure, that resulted in the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge early Tuesday morning in Baltimore, questions, who'd have thought it, are being raised about the nature of that incident. The bridge was a crucial artery for the Baltimore Beltway, known as I-695, and it saw a huge section plummet into the Patapsco River after a cargo ship, one way or the other, managed to collide with one of its major support columns. As we talked about yesterday, seasoned journalist Laura Logan, in a statement Tuesday, alleged the incident was not an accident. Incident, obviously, but rather a strategic attack. And that claim gathered further attention as she joined Steve Bannon on the War Room to discuss the implications of the bridge's demolition. And she asked this key question then. Why is anybody in a so-called position of authority coming to the mic and telling the country that it's not, it couldn't be terrorism, when in fact your own intelligence agencies are telling you it is? And in fact, anybody with a brain would not rule out something so obvious until there was actual evidence proving otherwise. She continued to explain that her sources, a mix of active duty and retired personnel from various agencies, believe the bridge collapse was a cyber attack targeting a major supply chain corridor. By Thursday, she had an update, referencing analyses from experts in various fields, including behavioral analytics, counterterrorism, and national security, who offered a combined two-pronged theory about the bridge collapse. And as she put it on X, analysis from specialists in those fields have said the following. This is their view. Based on their training experience, this was two types of operation. One, penetration testing, where they probe and test to identify vulnerabilities in our responses and defenses, sick. And two, a shaping operation to set the conditions and prepare the battlefield for a potential, and I would say at this point, pretty much inevitable future event. The concern is that other critical infrastructure and disruptions and or hits recently that appeared to be independent, isolated events might just not be after all. For example, remember that Ohio chemical disaster, the train derailment? Which was exacerbated by idiots deciding, hey, let's just make some dioxin, start a conflagration to burn all the minor poisons into something far worse, and contaminate the entire region with deadly poison. That was followed by a string of amazing coincidental food processing plant and etc. fires. When taken in isolation, they may not appear to be that significant, but you put them all together, they could, say the experts, indicate shaping or stacking operations, paving the way for an even bigger event wherein they do any number of these types of operations together, simultaneously or bang, bang, bang in short order. And guess what, folks? They have battalions, at least seven or so communist Chinese troops alone, say various experts like General Flynn, and anybody that can say, hey, what are the odds if you got 10 million invaders crossing into the country without any kind of vetting whatsoever that, oh, even 1% of them just might be terrorists or military or special forces from other not-so-friendly powers, and that would include nowadays the swamp? Well, if a criminal in the White House with his finger on the nuclear button isn't enough, that could certainly paralyze what's left of the United States. So, the critical question that we should all be asking, because government won't, is when will they trigger a multiple episode that can cause that paralysis effect? Some of the indicators, she said, and how many such incidents have occurred within a relatively short timeline, and what they see as a departure from what is normal, are key to understanding it, and her experts believe without question that those in charge will make sure any investigation into the bridge crash, quote, goes nowhere quick. One of the goals here is to give the public mental anesthesia while they test this, using train derailments or exposures to chemicals like in Ohio, when they told everyone to shelter indoors. And then they asked questions like, did they comply? Is this going to be successful at deceiving and causing the desired behavioral change? Hey, remember they all drank the Kool-Aid, took the shots, and wore the face diapers, didn't they? Then they use the media to create the assumptive narrative. They don't want the facts analyzed because they don't want people processing or even thinking about what the truth might be. Because truth naturally leads to questions that simply must not be asked. And that's why the Supreme Court is good if they'll just cover up anything associated with the Ministry of Truth here. Remember that? But it would be foolish and naive, she continues, at the expense of national security, not to question Big Brother's narrative on the Baltimore Bridge demolition, given the level of corruption in spheres of power and influence in this country today. What with many years of experience in spoofing, that's a tactic used in cyber warfare to hack into someone's system and deceive in order to achieve the desired outcome, they recognize that multiple indicators watching the video tell them that it was the GPS signal that was likely hacked, leading them to believe that perhaps they weren't as close to the bridge as they were, and it may be why in the video you see the crazy lean to port and then hard to starboard as they realize they weren't on course in spite of the GPS indicating that they were. In information warfare terms, here are some of the tactics you can see being used now that some of you might recognize. Number one, engineered complexity. Now, as an engineer, folks, this really resonates with yours truly. This is where they throw in nonsensical variables, aka information, but it's really not. It's disinfo. That's a term that they use to lie to you about what it is that they're doing to you. And it's engineered to distract, all designed to keep you from serially processing multiple channels and give you processing overload, preventing people from toggling the different channels of information, i.e., they create decoys to distract you from the truth. Number two, they're trying to reframe the issue by focusing on details that don't matter, by throwing in variables that aren't relevant to the main equation. I remember seeing the thing, could it be tainted fuel? Oh, yeah, you blithering idiots, that's a great explanation, right? Even if the fuel was tainted, what are the odds that you can somehow manage to hit that bullseye with a 100,000-ton ship, in spite of people maybe trying to avoid it? Those are the kind of distractions that are ultimately just plain too stupid for stupid. Says the PSYOP-related piece here, common sense, skepticism, and intelligence are huge overlays, all of which get in the way of manipulating human behavior, so they have to learn to analyze how you can create channel overload while people try to toggle or handle different channels of information, things like the speed of the boat, temperature of the water, etc. Baffle them with bullshit is a term you've probably heard. Number three, they need folks to be loaded up with enough variance to create that channel overload, so you create an error that then they can use to discredit you. One way is to create doubt in yourself, most effective because then people make themselves less efficient when your brain is processing the self-doubt and it propagates into the future. Population, bottom line, is so much easier to dupe today than it ever was 20 years ago. And the dumbing down of the mass population is certainly a big key on that score, folks. If they'll believe that this last rigged election was honest and even the most secure in American history, in spite of all the dead people that voted over and over again, and the electronic paper trails that aren't paper and that they're not going to show you anyway, and that the vaccine is safe and effective, come on. Be honest, what can't they sell you, especially if it's deadly poison? And I'll paraphrase now the last sentence in this piece. The incident, to put it mildly, at the Francis Scott Key Bridge should no longer be viewed solely as a tragic accident, an incredible series of unlikely events all coming together perfectly, as was not planned, but rather as a potential, probably likely harbinger of much more complex and numerous threats facing a dumbed-down and defenseless United States today. From there, let's take a look back at the earlier part of the week, before that latest act of U.S. economic and infrastructure demolition. And quite a weekend it was. World War III is in full swing, heading towards what looks increasingly like a nuclear inevitability. We had the usual conspiracy theories eventually proven correct with more and more examples of, yeah, it really was treason. There was a major terror event in Moscow over the weekend, and increasingly it looks like the same geniuses that took out the Nord Stream pipelines are behind this one too, and it may even end up being more obvious sooner. But in the unlikely event that you missed it, the story goes something like this, depending upon which sources you look to. Terrorists, or at least somebody's paid assassins, attacked a major music venue in Krasnogorsk, a suburb northwest of Moscow, on Friday afternoon, Russia time, just days after the American embassy in Russia warned citizens that you'd better get out of there because something's coming, which Russia, imagine this, seems to now find a bit suspicious. ISIS has taken credit for the deadly terror attack, which is about as close to an open admission that it was an American intelligence operation as you're going to get. Given us how we know, and Barack Hussein Obama even admitted it openly, that ISIS was trained and funded by United States intelligence, using the better part of a dozen terrorists armed with everything from grenades to fully automatic weapons. The assassins broke in, opened fire, and killed over 100 people, basically right off the top, and in the process, firebombed the building. As we approached the end of the weekend, the death toll was approaching 150. Some have been captured and confirmed that they were, in fact, paid assassins. They just don't really know, and this is no surprise, where the money actually came from. ISIS has formally claimed responsibility, and the Kremlin, again, no surprise, is demanding answers from Washington. And I don't believe, folks, that anybody really believes anybody else is ever going to tell the truth. But Jack Posobiec is among a number of respected reporters who are saying that CIA stench is all over this one. And furthermore, more and more people are pointing out, hey, what happened to all that weaponry that the Biden Führer oh so conveniently let slip into terrorists, Taliban, and probably, yep, maybe it's the same thing, but just different heads of the same Hydra, ISIS hands after the debacle in Afghanistan? It's the gift of terror that just keeps on giving. But I guess they knew better than to use American attack helicopters in the process. Commenting on the geopolitics, Jack Posobiec said that, quote, the issue is that Russia hasn't taken the bait yet. They want Russia to roll into Western Ukraine, to roll into Transnistria, to roll into a NATO neighbor, whether it's Finland, whether it's Poland, one of the Baltic states, said Posobiec. And so that's where these provocations are going. And unfortunately, he added, this isn't going to be the last one. It's the first of a new incursion, unquote. Dmitry Medvedev, who seems to have an increasingly good command of English epithets, has basically said, toning it down just a bit, that they're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. Still, though, the real question on everybody's mind seems to be, have the Biden-Führer's puppet masters finally provoked Russia into pulling out the stops and going for the nuclear option? And for that, I turn next to a piece from Russia Today by Dmitry Trenin, research professor at the Higher School of Economics and a fellow for the Institute of World Economy and International Relations, also a member of the Russian International Affairs Council, who said that it's time for Russia to give the West a nuclear reminder now that Washington is clearly openly waging a proxy war in a bid to inflict what he called a strategic defeat on Moscow, and a tougher response is thus needed. And noted Vox Day, this is the second public warning through Russia in less than a week that they're no longer willing to permit the USA and its proxies to continue waging a proxy war directly against them without experiencing some repercussions. Wrote Trenin, a proxy war between the nuclear powers is already underway. Moreover, in the course of this conflict, more and more restrictions are being removed, both in terms of the weapon system used and the participation of Western troops, as well as the geographical limits of the theater of war. It's possible, he continued, to pretend that a certain strategic stability is being maintained, but only if, like the U.S., the player set a task of inflicting a strategic defeat on the enemy at the hands of a client state and expects that the enemy won't dare use nuclear weapons. And that's a dangerous assumption, he pointed out, that's growing increasingly iffy. Because strategic stability in its original form, with the idea being to prevent a sudden and massive nuclear first strike, only partially retains its meaning under current conditions. Strengthening nuclear deterrence could be a solution to the real problem of restoring strategic stability, which has been seriously disrupted by the ongoing and escalating conflict. But he said, instead of a passive, we need to talk about an active form. Because the adversary, quote, should not remain in a state of comfort and believing that the war he is waging with the help of another country will not affect him in any way. In other words, it's necessary to put fear back into the heart and minds of enemy leaders. The beneficial sort of fear, he said, it's worth stressing. Because it also needs to be recognized that the limits of purely verbal intervention have been exhausted at this stage of the Ukrainian conflict. Channels of communication all the way to the top must remain open around the clock. But the most important messages at this stage, he said, must be sent through concrete steps, doctrinal changes, military exercises to test them, underwater and aerial patrols along the coast of the likely enemy, warnings about preparations for nuclear tests as well as the tests themselves, the imposition of no-fly zones over parts of the Black Sea, and so on. And he continued, the escalation ladder doesn't end there. Military technical steps can be followed by real acts, warnings of which have already been given. For example, attacks on air bases and supply centers of the territory of NATO countries and so on. There's no need to go further, he said. We just need to understand and to help the enemy to understand that strategic stability in the real and not narrow technical sense of the word is just not compatible with armed conflict between nuclear powers, even if, for the time being, it's being waged indirectly. Which takes us to the break. We'll have more Black Swans after the bottom of the hour.
Another one buys the dust. Another one buys the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another one buys the dust. Hey, hey, gonna get you too. Another one buys the dust.
Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I am still your host, Mark Hall, and we're still talking about some things that you might have found hard to believe not too long ago, especially if Big Brother thought you might not be paying attention. When nobody was looking, in the wee hours of Saturday morning, the whores in the House and Senate, both wings of the same evil bird of prey in both evil houses, did exactly what you knew blankety-blank and well they were gonna. The sellouts and the turncoats and the traitors, is there much difference anymore, all got together and passed another $1.2 trillion of new printed money. They call it a spending bill, and at least that part is more or less accurate. Because wouldn't it be horrible if this criminal government had to shut down, or even pretend to, just a bit? As if we cared, Zero Hedge's summary, and there are a whole lot of these up online, says the passage of the over 1,000-page bill that no one actually read anyway in a 74-24 vote in the Senate concludes several months of bogus drama on Capitol Hill centered around so-called Republicans demanding deeper spending cuts. Well, less outrageous spending increases, let's be honest, while they're still spending like drunken sailors, while the national debt has recently skyrocketed to over 34.5, but who's counting, trillion fiat unrepayable ever bucks. The bill passed shortly after the 12:01 a.m. midnight plus a minute deadline, indicating that some federal funding technically may have expired, but the White Whorehouse Budget Office, what a laugh that is, said, no, they're not going to declare a shutdown, and so until it's declared, it doesn't exist. Kind of like if you don't declare that Biden's seen out or the emperor has no clothes, he must not be. And if you're curious, there were 101 rhino traitors in the House of Communists, along with 185 Democrats, meaning the pork bill passed the House by 286-134. And, oh yeah, let's not forget, Speaker for the Traitors, Mike Johnson of Louisiana, and Senate Majority Leader Chucky Schumer of New York are all flapping in unison. After the latest debacle played out, MTG, Marjorie Taylor Greene, introduced a resolution to vacate, in other words, introduced a resolution to oust this scumbag, too. And the Epoch Times notes that, ironically, but maybe not in the least surprisingly, a whole bunch of Democrats who suddenly love this new rhino may block, may save Johnson from being ousted by the few remaining actual Republicans in either chamber. While you may recall that all the House Democrats voted with the Gang of Eight Republicans back in 2023, led by Matt Gaetz of Florida, to oust the scumbag Kevin McCarthy, several House Democrats this time around are saying, hey, why would we want to get rid of this guy? He's on our team, and he won't suffer a similar fate. Here's a related story, certainly illustrative, courtesy of Jordan Conradson and the Gateway Pundit, which says the Senate Democrats, communists all, on Friday night voted unanimously, listen to this carefully, to continue facilitating the nation's invasion by shooting down an amendment from Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Hagerty to the swamp spending bill that would have prevented the use of American newly printed fiat tax dollars to fly illegal invaders from foreign airports into various U.S. cities. Yeah, the term your tax dollars at work almost has new meaning, folks. So understand, and this is not a surprise, the disastrous latest sellout does nothing to secure the border, and I guess that's an improvement because the other one would have positively opened the floodgates even wider. giving even more invasion powers to the Fuhrer. But it still funds all the unconstitutional, illegal crap that the regime's been getting away with, from LGBTQ programs and cutting the genitalia off kids, to funding the Biden-Fuhrer attack on the Second Amendment with yet another federal gun-grab operation and more red flag infringements. Said Bill Hagerty, posting a clip from the Senate floor on Friday night, "Every single Democrat voted against my amendment that would have stopped the Biden-Fuhrer, he didn't spell it right, from using taxpayer dollars to continue to charter flights for hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens from their home countries directly to American towns to be resettled, countries like Venezuela and Haiti." And he concluded, "Make no mistake here, the Biden-Fuhrer has been secretly flying hundreds of thousands of illegals from foreign countries into blue city airports. And in 2023 alone, last year, it was reported that some 320,000 illegal invaders had been flown in using this method." Oh, yeah, and this, too, quick related story. Again, courtesy of the Epoch Times, as well as Zero Hedge, a federal judge, sick on Thursday, late last week, dismissed a lawsuit challenging a District of Criminal Swamp law, sick, that allows, get this, what they call non-citizen residents to vote in local elections and run for office as well. Judge Amy Berman Jackson, guess who appointed her, folks? And if you said the Obama-Fuhrer, who's still really running the country, you'd be right, found that a group of seven citizen plaintiffs lacked standing to challenge the legislation. But it's okay. The illegals can come in, and they have all the standing they need to overturn your nation's rule of law. Because guess what? Have you figured it out yet? While you were sleeping, they took that away, too. It's no longer your nation, not even remotely. America's biggest bankster, at least openly, Jerome Powell, chairman of the Fed, appeared on 60 Minutes recently and essentially lied through his teeth. But while that's not a surprise, some of the specifics probably are. Listen first to the setup from sycophant Scott Pelley.
Jerome Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, may have just rescued the economy from inflation without throwing millions out of work.
All hail the gods of Mount Olympus. Well, that is, if you believe the official numbers, and you shouldn't.
When Americans were suffering through the highest inflation in 40 years, Powell's Fed raised interest rates 11 times to cool the economy. Economists expected a recession, but now inflation is tumbling while employment is near a 50-year high.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. Well, I ain't got a witness, and I can't prove it, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Thursday, we met Powell for a rare interview.
But we promised him softballs and plenty of CYA, and we both delivered.
Is inflation dead?
I wouldn't go quite so far as that. What I can say is that inflation has come down really over the past year and fairly sharply over the past 6 months. We're making good progress.
And as long as we can keep a lid on any kind of an honest fourth estate, we think we can get away with it. At least until it's way too late, after the election and the shelves of Walmart are empty. Before we get to the heart of the matter, here comes another big lie.
The Federal Reserve was empowered in the Great Depression to regulate the economy by controlling the supply of money.
Oops, actually it was 1913, prior to World War I, when the end of constitutional money really took place. And what's known as the creature from Jekyll Island, thank you, G. Edward Griffin, was empowered to put a wooden stake in what was left of the concept of honest weights and measures, and the idea of unlimited powers that might be bound, as Jefferson put it, by the chains of the Constitution. But here's a major warning that the wheels may be just about to come off that wagon, and it involves a huge lie, courtesy of Pelley and Powell. And just to set this up, a quick reminder. Starting with COVID-19, the plandemic, the Zyklon B injection, and the literal destruction of commercial real estate all across some of the biggest blue-run cesspool cities in the country, primarily places like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and others, commercial real estate has honestly never recovered. But then when you add to it what New York City is doing to prove to investors that you got no business dealing with a place where the rule of law is literally a whim that we can disregard and then steal your stuff whenever we feel like it, commercial real estate, folks, is in dire, and I mean terminal trouble in the United States. As Martin Armstrong essentially put it not too long ago, New York in particular may be about to go no bid, and ultimately, last one to leave, turn out the lights. So here's the question that comes as close as Scott Pelley did to an actual fastball.
The value of commercial office buildings all across the country is dropping as people work from home.
Notice all the things he didn't say. Oh, well.
Those buildings support the balance sheets of banks all across the country. What is the likelihood of another real estate-led banking crisis?
I don't think that's likely. We looked at the larger banks' balance sheets, and it appears to be a manageable problem.
We bailed them out before, remember? And we're not about to let our puppet masters go down this time either. But we certainly learned not to ever call it a bailout again. Let's hear the whole whopper, though.
We looked at the larger banks' balance sheets, and it appears to be a manageable problem. There's some smaller and regional banks that have concentrated exposures in these areas that are challenged. And, you know, we're working with them.
You believe it's a manageable problem?
I think it
appears
to be.
We're not going to see bank failures across the country as we did in 2008.
I don't think there's much risk of a repeat of 2008.
No, this time around will make 2008 look like that first attack on the World Trade Center that everybody's forgotten about.
Certainly there will be some banks that have to be closed or merged out of existence because of this. That'll be smaller banks, I suspect, for the most part.
And there it is. And you might let that slide if you didn't recognize just how serious the situation actually is. And while this is something your host has been talking about for literally multiple years now, the update that comes next is courtesy of Wine Press News that says Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell conceded earlier this month that he and the feds, along with the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, are aware of and monitoring a number of banks that are likely to fail sometime in the near future, primarily due to their overexposure to CRE, or commercial real estate, and losses. As a matter of fact, folks, huge losses, because a lot of these buildings are just plain empty and never likely to be occupied again. Losses on their balance sheet, and in part, yep, it is because of higher interest rates, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. The problem is, if nobody wants to rent these things anyway, and between offices and restaurants and downtown stores and the cesspools, it becomes a very much vicious circle, particularly when out-of-control crime puts a wooden stake in what's left of them, especially when the rates are so high that you can't possibly turn a profit or even reduce incredible losses. You're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, and therein lies the rub. The entire commercial real estate market in the United States, like it or not, and let's go Brandon, has been turned into an albatross, or worse. And as the Wine Press News story notes, during a Senate Banking Committee hearing earlier this month, Powell acknowledged all of that, but said it is the medium and small regional banks that are affected. No! Pay no attention to that great big bank behind the curtain. Federal data, says the piece, unfortunately betrays Powell's words that it's not only the regional banks that are most affected by an overexposure to CRE and bogus loans that will never be repaid. On March 7th, the same day Powell gave his testifying to the Senate Banking Committee, the FDIC issued their own public meeting and contradicted Powell's words, saying that it's actually the large institutions, you know the names, that also have heavy exposure to commercial real estate and that are also, very much in a whole heap of trouble. Here's how Chairman Martin Grunberg put it during his announcement at the FDIC quarterly bank profile in the fourth quarter of last year, in which he stated, quote, the increase in non-current loan balances was greatest among the CRE loans and credit cards. Weak demand for office space, gee, do you think, has softened property values, and higher interest rates are affecting credit quality and refinancing ability of office and other types of commercial real estate loans. As a result, the non-current rate for non-owner occupied CRE loans is now at its highest level since the first quarter of 2014, driven by portfolios at, are you sitting down, the largest banks. There are lots of charts that follow, basically making the same point, but essentially, since 2022, past due loans on commercial real estate at the largest banks, those with more than $250 billion in assets, as of the end of 2023, are at 4.11%, which turns out to be 1 2/3% higher than at the end of the fourth quarter of the fateful year 2008, when banks were exploding all over Wall Street during what was called the then financial crisis. And, continues Jacob M. Thompson for Wine Press News, The Fed's also doing something else related to the growing losses at U.S. banks that should be deeply concerning. It has stopped providing the aggregated quarterly data, I guess if you don't like it, don't publish the data, on the loan loss reserves at commercial banks, something it had previously done quarterly since 1984. What an ironically appropriate year. Fed charts now come up with the words discontinued. And our concern, says the author, is that the largest banks, and by the way, according to the Federal Reserve, at the end of last year, there were only 13 banks in the United States with consolidated assets in that above $250 billion category. In any case, our concern, says the author, is that the largest banks are now woefully under-reserved given their potential commercial real estate, or even real estate in general, losses. Here's a chart with just some of the numbers in more or less order. JP Morgan is exposed to the tune of $1.4 trillion. Bank of America, $1.1 trillion. Citigroup, kind of a piker, just under $1 trillion. And Wells Fargo, about two-thirds of $1 trillion. And here's how the visual capitalist put it. The six largest U.S. banks saw delinquent commercial property loans nearly triple to $9.3 billion in 2023 amid, you know it, don't you, high vacancy rates and increased borrowing costs. Today, the sector is facing greater scrutiny from regulators amid growing risks, gee, do you think, to bank stability. In fact, for almost half of all U.S. banks, commercial real estate debt is the largest loan category overall. And while commercial loans are more heavily concentrated in small U.S. banks, several major financial institutions have amassed significant commercial loan portfolios. By the way, one of the smaller of those 13, and the chart makes this clear, New York Community Bank has recently had its credit rating lowered by Moody's to junk status. Says author Thompson, it appears that the data certainly suggests Powell is being disingenuous in his claims both to the Senate and to the nation. Which, of course, and this just extends the irony, folks, is not to discount the reality that many medium and small regional banks are really also in deep kimchi. Again, notes the visual capitalist, there's roughly $5.7 trillion in commercial real estate debt outstanding, and U.S. banks hold approximately half of that total on their balance sheets. And as your host, folks, let me ask this question in the current context. Would you like to be a major or even a small regional bank underwriting a whole bunch of commercial real estate loans in, say, the Baltimore metro area today? Two more items from the piece. Earlier this month, New York Federal Reserve Board member Scott Reckler said in a paper that he expects roughly 500 or so banks to fail over the next couple of years, largely because of their CRE exposures. And to make matters worse, the Federal Reserve has abruptly ended their so-called emergency bailout program as of this month. It's called the Bank Term Funding Program, or BTFP, which provided, past tense, lines of credit for banks who needed extra liquidity to cover withdrawals and net losses on their balance sheet. And an increasing number of banks, says the story, were still taking advantage of the program up until the BTFP was terminated. As he wraps up the piece, Thompson really pulls out the stops and says, as I've oft pointed out, if you needed me to do so again, Jerome Powell or any one of these bankster gangsters, as he put it correctly, are trained stone-cold liars. They won't flinch or blink when telling a lie. Truth be told, we knew that the mega banksters definitely had plenty of commercial real estate exposure, but the evidence and admission given by the FDIC clearly contradicts the notion that this problem is limited to only the regional banks. On the contrary, it is affecting banks of all sizes. And last year around this time, he noted, amidst the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and a wave of international contagion that spread because of it, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen was called upon to give answers during a Senate Banking Committee hearing, during which time Yellen made an important admission, basically revealing that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury will set in motion measures to bail out and rescue the so-called too-big-to-fail and, as we know, folks, too-big-to-jail banks or any institution that the Fed feels is big enough, and that means they wield enough power over the members there, of significant importance to them, in other words. But small and medium banks had better not expect such favorable treatment. Said Yellen, quote, a bank only gets that treatment if a supermajority of the Fed board and I, in consultation with the president, you know, the fake guy, or at least those pulling his puppet strings, conclude that failure to protect uninsured depositors would create systemic risk to the banking system. And she went on to explain that other banks, like Signature Bank, another bank that collapsed in the tidal wave caused by the fall of SVB, and oh, by the way, did you hear this? Just this week, what an amazing coincidence, Sam Bankster-Fraud, SBF, you know, the head honcho at SVB and the second biggest Democrat donor of all time, was convicted of what was called by the court one of the biggest financial frauds in American history and sentenced to 25 years at Club Fed. What do you bet he'll get a better penthouse suite than Peter Navarro will? But still, if he knows what's good for him, he'd better make sure those TV cameras in his cell are working. Back to Jacob M. Thompson's conclusion here. Yellen was telling us what some of us have already been warning about. She's now joining the chorus. Forecasting in advance what is intended to occur. You and I, he says, will be forced to bail out these so-called too-big-to-fail banksters, while your own little bank can go eat dirt and be forced to shutter its doors only to be consolidated by one of the mega banks. In this coming wave of bank failures that we'll see this year and into 2025, one, if not more, of these mega banks will be sacrificed, similar to how Lehman Brothers, remember them, was sacrificed on the altar during the Great Recession back towards 2008. From what I've been hearing, says Thompson, from a number of analysts, it would seem that the Bank of America might be the sacrificial cow that gets slaughtered, but I guess we'll have to just wait and see. Bottom line, and for the umpteenth time, and he is not alone on this, folks, I think this is sage counsel, get your money out of these places, and of course, if you know what's really at hand, get yourself out of fiat currencies altogether, especially the almighty fake dollar. Keep only the amounts you need to maintain a balance, pay bills, maybe make some purchases, but keep most of it out of the fake fiat coming down around your ankles system in the eventuality that your bank collapses and or is hit with bank runs. And of course, ultimately, you know what's coming. Scripture warns us about it. It's called the central bank digital currency, complete big brother control, and also known as the mark of the beast. As the week wrapped up, we had several more indications that the Fed and the various bureaus of lying statistics were only getting started when it came to fudging the numbers. One of the Fed's favorite indicators, says Zero Hedge, the core PCE deflator was flat this month, 2.8% year over year, as expected. Still above the alleged target, but the headlines claim that's good news. As if people should believe the official numbers rather than what they see on the grocery shelves. What your host thought was most interesting as the week roared to a close was this piece from Zero Hedge and the Philadelphia Fed, which has just admitted that U.S. payrolls are lied about, overstated by at least 800,000 or so fake jobs. The first red flags, the piece says, emerged in the summer of 2022 when the Biden Labor Department started to well and truly rig labor market data. There's a lot of charts and detail here, but essentially what happened was a separation between two different measures of jobs data, the establishment survey and the more accurate household survey, which had tracked each other for years, tick for tick. But in March of 2022, a wide gap opened up, which quickly grew to 1.5 million jobs in just 3 months. Somebody's lying. There follows a lot of graphs and verbiage about how the discrepancy could be explained by the record surge in multiple job holders. You know, a government shill trots out the claim they've created 1 million new jobs, and somebody in the front row says, I know, I got 3 of them. There are related issues about the quality of jobs and part-time jobs and so forth. But what it all boils down to are a couple of startling facts. Starting in 2022 and accelerating over recent months, less and less full-time jobs have been added. Now we have the absurd situation where all the new jobs in the last year have been part-time jobs. But wait, there's more. Given all the foreign-born invaders, it turns out that not only has all job creation over the past 6 years, since May of 2018, not been all it's cracked up to be, but it has benefited exclusively foreign-born workers. But two more pages of graphs and data later, it's now clear, writes Zero Hedge, that we really didn't even know how manipulated the data was until early 2024. Yeah, there have been a lot of downward revisions of virtually all the job prints from last year. But now, thanks to the Philadelphia Fed, we learned that the BLS overstated payrolls in 2022 by 1.1 million jobs. And here we go again. This time, the BLS overstated payrolls through December 2023 by another 800,000 and more if we extend the data series into 2024, making things look a lot better than they really are. Who could have imagined such a thing? So regardless of the other lies you're hearing from the Fed, the labor market is far weaker than has been generally believed. And guess what? That's why, says Zero Hedge, neither the deep state nor the waste stream media will ever mention this report. I'll close with a really interesting late update courtesy of a shipping blog called G Captain and Zero Hedge that tells us that there is a huge problem for the Pentagon. Well, that is, if they intended to go to war anytime soon, well, or escalate. A whole bunch of cargo ships have been trapped in Baltimore after that bridge demolition. But perhaps more concerning to those wanting to fight a war, the U.S. Maritime Administration, MARAD, has what's called a Ready Reserve Force. And it turns out two of their high-speed military cargo ships are also stuck behind the collapsed bridge. According to a site called the War Zone, or TWZ, they're Algol-class vessels and some of the fastest cargo vessels of their general size anywhere in the world. They're part of the U.S. Maritime Administration National Defense Reserve Fleet and provided surge sea lift capability to the Pentagon for overseas conflicts. Breitbart News reported that the Department of Transportation won't actually say how many National Defense Ready Reserve Fleet ships are stuck in the Baltimore Harbor. You know, the DOT secretary didn't even know what they are anyway. But analysts warn that those stuck RRF vessels are a huge problem if war was to escalate. And they weren't even taken out by a missile or a drone. Just allegedly. And are you still buying this? An incredible series of unfortunate events.